Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books, an independent New Orleans bookstore. Additional support comes from the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, WWNO's weekly look at the New Orleans literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week I'll be talking with poet Jerry Ward, whose new book is Fractal Song. We'll also hear from Jamie Attenberg and Adrian Van Young about the Writers Resist literary event coming up January 15th. Dr. Jerry Ward Jr. was born in Washington, D.C., grew up in Mississippi, and has lived in New Orleans for many years. He recently retired after a distinguished career teaching at Dillard University, and before that, at Tougaloo College. He is a distinguished overseas professor at Central China Normal University in Wuhan, China. And the last time we visited, we were talking about his book, The Katrina Papers. Today, we're exploring a new book of poems, Fractal Song. Jerry Ward, I'm so happy to welcome you back to The Reading Life.
Thank you for having me back.
Now, I have to confess, I have only the vaguest notion of fractals, so I had to look that up before I began to read the book. But once I did, it illuminated all these poems for me. So tell me about the title, first of all.
The title came by accident. I did not set out to entitle a book Fractal Song. But I was thinking about the nature of my poetry, how I have written poetry for many, many years, and something that I notice about my own poems and the poems of others, and that is repetition. I find that perhaps some poets are writing the same poem over and over. I hope I'm not doing that. And you have to fight against it, you know, because there are themes which are favorites of yours, or there are words which recur over and over in various contexts. So I said, well, that's like fractals.
Uh-huh. Yeah. And also there are abiding concerns that people keep coming back to and looking at in new ways.
Right. And fractal, as I thought more about it, was a good choice, Susan, because it refers to mathematics first. But it refers to the kind of math that tries to explain things in terms of non-Euclidean geometry, which allows us to at least have descriptions of shorelines, of mountain ranges. So you're describing nature, but also fractals in form occur in nature. And I would also use an analogy of something about the nature of history as a process, not as a narrative necessarily, but as a process, being fractal. So you have a lot of latitude to play with under this notion of what is fractal and what isn't. And then I got curious, and I said, is there fractal poetry? Yes, there is. Just check the internet and you will find that there have been many, many discussions and many examples written of fractal poetry. And it won't look at all like what you would think a fractal poem should be, but many people are playing with the concept and how do you use it and then riff on it or make variations.
Now, you see a long continuum in this book, or I do as a reader. So you write about a 14-year-old boy growing up in Mississippi. Then you write about Trayvon Martin, and you're making this long and important historical connection. That's one of the great vantage points of age, don't you think?
I think it's a vantage point of age. It's also something that I tried to incorporate when I was teaching. I always insisted that students should have a sense of history. I was a little disappointed when students came and did not know certain things, and then I was not blaming them for not knowing. It was a matter of their never having been told or never having been taught something, and I would say, well, you must read this, you must read that. Why? Because I want you to understand how you are connected to a long series of events. things that happened thousands of years ago or maybe yesterday that you don't think about, and things that happen in various parts of the world, because we are not, as human beings, atomic in the sense of being free-floating. And John Donne made a wonderful No Man Is an Island statement about that, and many other writers and thinkers have done it, talking about the brotherhood of man or how interconnected people are. And certainly in our 21st century, we are aware that perhaps we are a little more connected than we would like to be through social networking, Instagram, and phones that blow up in your face. But in history, if you don't have a sense that people did things before you were born that still have some impact on what you're going to do tomorrow, I think you can survive in the world. I don't know of any people in the world who are totally lacking of a sense of history or of the existence of duration. However, I think we bring different degrees of awareness to it. So as I write, I'm not always self-conscious about history, but somehow it slips in.
So 14 in Mississippi is such a timeless poem in so many ways, but Trayvon, Your Eyes Are Haunting Me, is such a contemporary poem rooted in a specific event known to so many people. It's so interesting to me to have that temporal context in these two works. So I wonder if you'd read your poem about Trayvon Martin.
Right, and I'll preface it very quickly, Susan, by saying, as you noticed, the epigram here is from someone who has a lot of New Orleans history, Bob Kaufman. Mm-hmm. In fact, he's an iconic poet of the 1950s associated with the San Francisco beatniks. But, you know, he's very much a part of this city. And when you read his poetry, from which I took this phrase, "Would You Wear My Eyes," which is a beautiful poem from Solitudes, I did not try to imitate Kaufman here, but a lot of Kaufman comes through for me. So I'll read, Trayvon, Your Eyes Are Haunting Me. Compassion, would you wear my eyes? Did you say you would wear my eyes? Would you read the gothic tale of life leaking from the double helix of my skin? Compassion, did you see what I saw when you broke the fifth seal of the watch so I could see death praying after me? See what you've done? Blood blinding white around my invisible race. America, old negated rainbow, smeared on the paralyzed sky. Mercy, would you wear my eyes to see crosswires training on my suspicious back? Mercy. Are you drunk with the blood of saints, feasting on hate, blessed manna in the gated neighborhood? See what you've undone? Sprigs of green dying in the sea of glass. Love, would you wear my eyes? Did God say you could wear my eyes? Trayvon, your eyes are haunting me. Essence of innocence is haunting me. Affiliated with angers, now I see the bullets that came for you are coming for me. Your eyes are haunting me. They're watching the negated rainbow. Compassion, mercy, and love in your eyes are cheap and dust. And I shall wear your eyes until revelation scream, what is just?
Ah, how long did it take you to write that poem? I mean, was that an immediate response? Was that something you thought about for a long time and then
I think it took several weeks. I write poems in very different ways. There are some that come in a great rush and only have to be edited. There are others that have to be constructed as if you're building a house. This was one of the constructed ones. And I had certain lines, there are certain allusions here too, that I wanted to use. And if you look in the book, there's another poem about eyes, but that poem happens to be very deliberately about James Baldwin and not about what is happening currently. So when I decided I had to write something about Trayvon Martin, I was so injured, so wounded by his death, that I said, maybe I don't want to write a poem of direct anger. Maybe I want to let the anger seep through in a very different way. And it took me a while to figure out exactly how to do that and how to try to evoke love and compassion and mercy and the line, would you wear my eyes? And then I thought about the Kaufman poem and about the surrealism of that poem and the suffering that that poem speaks of about the body. And I said, that's just right.
You reference the work of several other poets, and you write poems for other poets in this book. Alice Walker, you just spoke of Bob Kaufman, who never gets the attention he should receive, I think. James Baldwin, of course, Dave Brinks, Neo Sundari. That's such an act of generosity. What is it that's special about writing a poem for another poet?
Well, at least you know that the other poet will probably read you. The important thing is having one's poems read or heard. Mm-hmm. And I've said many times that I always wanted to have whatever, if what I wrote was of any value, I wanted people to read it. And I ensured that that would happen by publishing mainly in magazines or in live readings. The generosity that you mentioned, Susan, is something that I think should apply to us, whether we are poets or any other kinds of writers or just citizens in the world, that we try to be generous to people. Most of us don't have very much money, but we may have talent and we can craft something and give it to another person as a gift. And I think that's why I will dedicate something I have written to another poet.
Now, some of these poems have been around for a long time. Some of them go back many years, and some of them are fairly new. So I'm curious to know if the process of putting this book together made you see older poems anew, perhaps, or see your work in a different context as you look at a poem compared to what you're writing now. I'm just curious about how that process made you feel about your own work.
I had to look at the older poems as poems that were akin to or radically different from the ones that I write now. And I found more kinship than difference. As I compiled the book, I really wanted to make it chronological, but I could not because I didn't date all of my poems. And I knew what was older and what was new, but I didn't always know the exact date. So I said, that's futile. I can't do that. So I decided to put the poems into three sets, and I hope that there is some kind of thematic unity among the poems in those sets, and if there is, that's great. If there isn't, that's great too, as long as people read them.
Right. That's the bottom line. Let's get everyone to read these poems.
Right.
So I'm curious to know how this extended time you've spent in China has influenced your writing, changed your writing.
In terms of my involvement with China, I am trying to build cultural bridges and to increase the understanding that Chinese scholars and the students they teach will have of American literature and particularly of African American literature because they want me to talk about that most of the time. So how I write for them is influenced by my sense that when you're working in a second language, it might be appreciated if the person who's a native speaker or writer tries to present ideas to you in ways that are not too complicated. So although I'm writing about criticism and literature and theory, I try to very carefully avoid using too much jargon. I don't try to speak down to them. But if I use what we would call a difficult word because the concept is difficult, I will try to re-describe it in some way so that they will grasp it, because I don't want to impose more agony upon these bright young people than they need to have.
Well, there are a lot of great ideas and wonderful things in this book, that is for sure. We've been talking with Dr. Jerry W. Ward Jr., whose new book is Fractal Song, Poems. Jerry, thank you so much.
Thank you.
It's a great pleasure to welcome my next two guests to The Reading Life. Jamie Attenberg's most recent novel is St. Maisie, and she has a new book, All Grown Up, coming out in March. Also with us is Adrienne Van Young, whose most recent novel is Shadows of Summerland. Together, they're organizing the New Orleans event for Writers Resist, a series of literary events being held all across the country on January 15th, Martin Luther King's birthday. Welcome, Jamie.
Hi.
Hi, Adrienne.
Hi, great to be here.
So, Jamie, there are going to be a series of Writers Resist events held all over the country in collaboration with Penn, and they're all going to take place on the same day. So tell me how you two got involved with this larger effort.
Well, actually, this is the third time Adrienne and I have actually ever even met in person. We both, I think, experienced a similar feeling immediately after the election. What can we do? How can we organize writers? So he and I both separately were sending out emails to people that we knew saying, what can we do? Can we get together for something? Can we have some sort of action or some sort of event? And then people kept emailing us saying, you guys should talk to each other. So that's kind of how it got started. And then I received an email about the bigger Writers Resist Parent event, which is co-sponsored with Penn. And I immediately suggested that we become participants in this.
But the point of this is really bipartisan, nonpartisan. You know, it's not specifically political. Am I right?
Yes, it's billed, I think, as a nonpartisan event in that it has no political affiliation. I suppose some political affiliation is implicit in the event itself. But yes, I think it is meant to bring people together in kind of a forum of artistic expression.
And, it, you know, really, I think initially it was started as a response to the inauguration. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if it's an anti-inauguration, but it's a re-inauguration. You know, core values about creativity and freedom of speech and freedom of expression and how those things are important to us as artists and us as parts of our community and us as Americans.
And writers resist many things. You know, a big part of being a writer is getting your truth off the page and speaking it to live audiences. So events like this are especially important now because they give people an outlet for feelings and frustrations, don't you think?
Yes.
Very true.
Yes. So you've had one meeting. So how did that go, Jamie?
It went really well. I think we had 15 people come who were going to be part of our core organizers, and probably another 40 people who've responded via email. And we anticipate we'll have about 40 people reading on the day of the event. And so maybe, you know, 50 or 60 people who are actually going to be collaborating and organizing this event.
It will likely be a long event. I think that people will probably trickle in and out. But yes, I think, as Jamie said, we're likely to have upwards of 40 readers.
So who are some of the readers who've signed on already?
Well, Zachary Lazar, who is a novelist and professor at Tulane. Tom Beller, also a professor and a novelist at Tulane. Maurice Ruffins, Lady Hubbard.
Tom Piazza, Gina Miner Allen.
Many people. And we're hoping also to have students from a couple of high schools in the area and college students as well.
Oh, that's great. Now, one of the things you've said is that people won't necessarily be reading their own work, that they'll be reading work that's intended to inspire and provoke, right? Mm-hmm. So what are some of the things people are thinking about reading?
I think this is something we've had an ongoing conversation about. Essentially, people are going to be putting in their own suggestions in terms of what inspires them specifically. Some people that we had put on the table, which we think are great. You know, an obvious one would be MLK, because we're, you know, having the reading close to his special day. Others would be Audre Lorde, Angela Davis,
James Baldwin, Allen Ginsberg,
Zoe Leonard.
It goes on and on. I mean, we just have so many people that we could just dig into. But I also want like an inspirational speech from Harry Potter.
Right.
Yeah, I really want a high school kid up there reading some Harry Potter, because everyone loves Harry Potter.
Okay, high school kids.
Yeah.
Words from Dumbledore. That would be great. That's
very nonpartisan.
Dumbledore's army. That's what this is.
Right. Harry Potter's as nonpartisan as you can get.
Well, I keep thinking about the last time I saw Grace Paley here. She was at Loyola and she did this wonderful reading, and she came out to the edge of the stage and she said, "So, are there any demonstrations, any meetings that you want to announce, anything you've got going on?" And a few people stood up and said, "Well, we have this meeting for this. Well, we have that." And then she walked all the way out to the very edge of the stage and she leaned forward and she shook her finger and she said, "Well, the rest of you have something for next time." Mm. And it's like, those are kind of words to live by,
Yeah. You
know, if you're a writer, have something for next time.
I think that we're just getting started.
So what else do you foresee unfolding after this initial event?
That's a very good question. I think it's something that me and Jamie have been peripherally discussing. I mean, I think that we would like to do further events as the next 4 years unfold. We can't say for sure that they would take kind of a similar social justice lens or what they would really be enmeshed in. But I think we would like to make it, you know, maybe, I don't know, something that we do every 3 months.
Yeah, and it would just be, you know, really nice. The people that we've had who are in our core group have talked about how their college kids and their high school kids would just go crazy for something like this and have that kind of space where they can communicate whatever their frustrations are or dreams are about what they envision this country should be and what arts and culture mean to them. So it would be great to have kind of this little subsection of it that goes off in that direction as well.
So what's the best way for people to get in touch with you all? What's the best way to sign on and help or take part?
I suppose coming to the event itself would be obviously a great start, because we're going to be there. I think it's going to be very clear who we are. I don't think either of us are going to be reading at the event, but we'll certainly be doing some amount of emceeing.
Right. And there's a Facebook invite for Writers Resist New Orleans. You can just Google that and it's there and anyone can access it there. There's a Writers Resist website that's at the national website, and my email address is available through that. I'm the contact on that.
And that's writersresist.org.
Yes.
So people can go there. Well, I thought I might ask one of you to read the statement from the national website so people will know what Writers Resist is all about on a national level.
Writers Resist is not affiliated with a political party. We wish to bypass direct political discourse in favor of an inspired focus on the future and how we as writers can be a unifying force for the protection of our democracy. In order for us to heal and move forward individually and as a nation, we believe people need something to be for in this anxious moment. The only thing we resist is that which attacks or seeks to undermine those most basic principles of freedom and justice for all.
We're looking at it as maybe a little bit of a witchcraft that might go on that day, you know, just people sort of like repeating these magical words from the past and it'll sort of guide us into the future.
Yes, we very much do want it to have like kind of an incantatory quality, which is why we decided on the medium of the extended multi-participatory reading as opposed to the sort of typical in a small bookstore reading, which, of course, we were both very dependent on in our careers, but Which seemed like something that could be pushed aside for the honor of the day.
A different, freer space, sort of.
Yes.
You know? So I think this is going to be a really great way to kick off the year, and I hope lots of people come. We've been talking with Jamie Attenberg and Adrian Van Young about the Writers Resist event. It's coming up January 15th at 2 p.m. at the Art Garage, 2231 St. Claude Avenue. For more information, visit writersresist.org or Writers Resist New Orleans, the Facebook page, and come on out. Jamie, Adrian, thank you both so much.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you very much.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. One Book, One New Orleans is gearing up for the coming year. If you have any suggestions for the 2017 book selection, send them in by noon Wednesday, January 11th. The project leaders will be meeting to narrow down the choices to the top three soon after. You can email suggestions to onebooknola@gmail.com. Lisa Wade discusses and signs American Hookup, The New Culture of Sex on Campus, Thursday, January 12th, at 6 at Octavia Books. The Octavia Columbia Book Science Fiction Book Club discusses Lord of Light by Roger Zelazny, Saturday, January 14th at 10:30 at Octavia Books. Children's book author John Bemelman's Marciano and illustrator Sophie Blackall present and sign Mischief Season, the first book in their new Witches of Benevento series, Saturday, January 14th at 2 at Octavia Books. New York Times bestselling author Karen Marie Moning debuts her new novel Fever Song, the conclusion to the Fever series, Sunday, January 15th at 9 at the Hotel Monteleone. Advance tickets must be purchased from Octavia Books. Plan now to attend Writers Resist, the New Orleans contribution to a national series of readings, a multi-author reading event designed to inspire activism and community, Saturday, January 15th from 2 to 5 at the Art Garage, 2231 St. Claude Avenue. For more information, check out writersresist.org or the Writers Resist New Orleans Facebook page. Today's guests, Jamie Attenberg and Adrienne Van Young, will be there, along with Zachary Lazar, Yuri Herrera, Maurice Carlos Ruffin, Gina Miner Allen, Katie Simpson Smith, Lady Hubbard, Khaled Hagazi, Andrea Young, and students from area high schools and universities. They'll be reading from the work of Martin Luther King Jr., Allen Ginsberg, James Baldwin, Angela Davis, and many others. Lydia Peel reads from and signs her debut novel, The Midnight Cool, with live music by her husband, Catch Secor of the Old Crow Medicine Show, Tuesday, January 17th at 6 at Octavia Books. The Women's National Book Association is holding its annual writing contest with four awards in the following categories: fiction, creative nonfiction, and poetry. The contest is open for submissions until January 15th. For more information, go to WNBA-books.org. Submissions are open until January 15th, and the winners will be announced May 1st, 2017. And here's something really exciting coming up at Tulane University. The Living Library takes place Thursday, January 26th from 11 a.m. to 3, and Saturday, January 28th from 1 to 4 at the Lavin Burnick Center for University Life. The Living Library was started in 2000 at the Roskilde Festival in Copenhagen, Denmark, and was organized by a youth organization called Stop the Violence. It's a personal way to promote mutual understanding and break down barriers, real or perceived, within a local community. Here's how it works. Individuals volunteer to be books, and attendees become readers who check out a book, meaning they sit with the volunteer to hear their story. If you'd like to volunteer to tell your story, check out LibGuides, that's LibGuides, tulane.edu/livinglibrary. If you're a student who's a fan of Jane Austen, consider entering the 2017 Jane Austen Society of North America's Essay Contest, which invites you to submit short essays that address imagining film or stage adaptations of Austen's work. Prizes are generous, and the deadline is May 21st, 2017. For more information, visit the Essay Contest page at jasna.org. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, Our Lady of Holy Cross College, and the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. The theme song and end music for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by Jenny Lawson and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. Or you can email us anytime at thereadinglife@wwno.org. I'm Susan Larson. Thanks for listening, and keep reading.